Mexico. I'm Bryce Dix. New Mexico is in the middle of one of its most dangerous fire seasons to date, with the largest wildfire in state history leaving hundreds of thousands of acres of our land scorched. A combination of two fires, the Calf Canyon Hermit's Peak fire, is stirring controversy because one part of it was originally a prescribed or planned burn that jumped its containment lines. Now, that fire is proving difficult for firefighters to battle and has forced thousands of people to evacuate and has destroyed hundreds of buildings and structures. But science points to fire, both natural and human-caused, as essential to forest ecosystems and their overall health when managed correctly and responsibly. Today on Let's Talk New Mexico, we'll dissect misconceptions about forest management, chat about the prescribed burn that would eventually become the Hermit's Peak fire, and tackle issues facing firefighters who we expect to both manage and fight wildfires in a time where climate change is fundamentally altering our fire seasons. We'll hear from folks who have done extensive research on the dilemmas facing forest managers and have vast knowledge of prescribed burns and forest management, along with a climate reporter who has seen the destruction that fire has caused in our state and has interviewed wildland firefighters on the ground. We'll also hear from former firefighters and policy advocates who are looking to change firefighter working conditions. And finally, we'll zoom into land grants here in the state and see how small stipulations in federal law are making it difficult for those communities to manage their forested lands. And we want to hear from you folks. Send questions or comments to letstalk@kunm.org. Tweet us with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM or call in and we'll take your questions live on the air this morning. That number to call is 505-277-5866. That's 277-KUNM. Have you or someone you know been affected by this or past fire seasons? Or are you wondering how to properly fireproof your home and property? Are you a current or former firefighter who has left or is thinking about leaving the field because of the low pay and mental health challenges? What are your thoughts and experiences in such dangerous work? What needs to change? Again, give us a call this hour at 505-277-5866. Tweet us with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM or send us an email at letstalk@kunm.org. And with that, I'd like to welcome Matthew Hurteau. He's a widely accomplished forest ecologist at the University of New Mexico with a focus on climate change mitigation and adaptation, as well as fire and forest ecology. Good morning, Matthew.
Good morning, Bryce.
Awesome. So to start us off, what is forest management for people who don't know, and what are some examples of it?
Yeah, so here in New Mexico, it's really about managing these disturbance processes like fire. So actions such as prescribed burning, managing natural ignitions and stuff like that are really integral to maintaining the process that creates the ecosystem structure that helps provide all the other stuff like wildlife habitat, the provision of water and things like that.
And so you focus heavily on the prescribed or planned burn aspect of forest management in your research. What are the benefits of fire instead of, let's say, forest thinning?
Yeah, so humans have been managing fire in these ecosystems for, you know, thousands of years, right? And then it's the cessation of that burning. So basically, we started putting them out about 120 years ago, and the forest got real dense, right? And so, you know, we've basically lost all the benefits that fire provides, and that increased density increases the risk of these, you know, uncharacteristic high severity wildfires. And so, you know, thinning can help restore some of the structure, but fire is really the integral process that's important for cycling nutrients, reducing the amount of fuel or dead plant material on the forest floor that can allow fire to transmit itself into the canopy.
Mm-hmm. And you did touch on this, but we do keep on hearing about fire being excluded from our forest from around a century. Is that right? Can you give us some context surrounding that history and why you think that's an issue?
Sure. So here in the Southwest, we had a large amount of grazing that actually reduced the amount of grasses and stuff like that in the forest. And that's what used to carry regular fire. And then, you know, starting around the early 1900s, there was a big wildfire in the Northern Rockies, referred to as the Big Burn, 1910, right? And that really changed our relationship with fire in this country. And that was about the same time our national forest system was established. And, you know, it burned through communities and things like that. And our understanding, our ecological understanding of these systems was not as advanced as it is now.
Mm-hmm. And so part of the reason why we're discussing fire this morning is because large portions of our state are burning out of control. What's your reaction to the prescribed burn that jumped its containment lines just outside of Mora, New Mexico?
Yeah, so that's, I mean, it's a tragedy for the folks who've been impacted by that fire. You know, the basic fact is that we live in flammable landscapes. I think the other fires that are occurring right now are evidence of the fact that the ignition source is kind of irrelevant from the perspective of that these landscapes are explosively flammable this year because of long-term drought and long-term fire suppression. Fire is an important piece of restoring or reducing that risk. And I think that in terms of that management piece, you know, and it seems like it's ongoing, there'll be a thorough investigation to figure out, you know, what exactly happened. And then we need to learn from that information and put safeguards in place to reduce the chance that that sort of thing happens again in the future.
Mm-hmm. And we did reach out to the U.S. Forest Service. I'm going to read their statement about the fire in just a moment, but I do want to touch on something you said. Lots of folks from northern New Mexico are feeling angry towards the federal government and specifically the U.S. Forest Service for this ignition. What was ignited in what seemed like poor burning conditions. Now, you are not a forest manager. I want to make that very clear. None of us here on the show this morning are and are involved in this prescribed burn that happened. Can you explain the parameter window that burn bosses use when deciding to ignite a prescribed burn or not?
Yeah, so basically what they have is they write this prescription in advance, and it specifies the range of moisture values in the dead plant material, so the fuels. It specifies the range of weather conditions that you need to be within. And those things, right, sometimes they work with each other and sometimes they work against each other. And so there's a fair amount of expertise involved in determining when is appropriate time to light.
Well, I did mention that I was going to read the USDA's Forest Service statement. So they are committed to conducting prescribed fire under safe conditions, they said. Their primary goal is engaging in both prescribed fires and fighting wildland fire, is ensuring the safety of the communities involved. Our employees are part of these communities across the nation. In rare circumstances, conditions change and prescribed burns move outside the planned project area and become wildfires. It is imperative that we learn from these experiences. This learning mindset applies directly to the escaped Las Despensas prescribed burn in New Mexico, now named the Hermit's Peak Fire. The Forest Service is now conducting a comprehensive internal declared wildfire review of the Las Despensas prescribed fire to understand changing conditions and work towards further mitigating risks in the future. The report will include a review of the conditions on the ground, the planning process and design, an assessment of the decisions leading up to the prescribed fire implementation, and a summary of contributing factors. The Forest Service will identify and communicate the next steps, they say, when the report is finalized. Matthew, I do want to say, to go off of that, some people might be wondering, how do I protect my home from wildfires? Do you have any ideas on how they can mitigate the risk in their area?
Yeah, so there's some great resources available online that you can find those through New Mexico's Division of Forestry. It's basically under FireWise communities, right? So there's a lot of information about how to manage the vegetation right around your house, about building materials and things like that. And you can actually get assessments done of your home to look at how risky, you know, your choices have been.
Mm-hmm. Well, and in talking before the show today, you've actually talked to me on the culture of fire in different places in the U.S. And you mentioned in the eastern part of the United States, there's a different culture of fire, essentially, in like Florida and Georgia. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. So, you know, they haven't been disconnected from fire as a process for as long as we have in the western U.S. I mean, folks have been burning all along. And, you know, people learn to live with that right up against their home property boundaries. They learn to live with the smoke. And it's an important part of managing the habitat, managing the forest, and also managing risk to homes from that vegetation buildup.
And can you compare that to places like New Mexico in the Southwest? We don't like burning that much, right?
Well, I think that we're building a better relationship with fire. We lost a lot of that, right? And you know, this is a very, like I said, fire has been a part of this these ecosystems for a long time and managed by humans for a long time. And what we need to do is we need to bring that relationship back, and we need to bring our understanding of the process back.
Awesome. Well, this is a great time to bring in our next guest, Laura Paskus. She's an environmental reporter at New Mexico PBS and hosts this great show called Our Land. Thanks for being here, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been following this fire season very closely on Twitter and through your reporting. You actually went down to the Calf Canyon Hermit's Peak fire in the nearby city of Las Vegas to do some reporting for Our Land. What did you see there?
Yeah, and I just want to say, like, thank you to all of the reporters all around New Mexico who are doing fantastic reporting all across the state. So I've been going out and sort of looking at Cerro Pelado, and also we went up to see Hermit's Peak and Calf Canyon. And I think, you know, the scale of these fires and how quickly they're burning and how quickly they're burning in these dried out landscapes is something that's just remarkable. You know, I'm looking at the numbers this morning. Hermit's Peak and Calf Canyon's over 300,000 acres now, but the Black Fire, which ignited in the Gila just last Friday, is already at 92,000 acres in 6 days.
Well, and you're not new to climate reporting, and you're talking about how crazy these numbers are you're seeing being reported. What stands out to you about this fire season compared to our past fire seasons? Is there anything different in years past?
Yeah, I mean, just the scale of these fires, the intensity of these fires this early in the season. I know that there have been wildfires in April and May before, but I cannot think of a season that we've ever had in New Mexico's recorded history that's anything like what's happening right now. You know, I just last night, I went up to the east side of the Sandias to kind of say goodbye to a favorite spot before the forest closed this morning. Yeah. And the crunchiness, the dryness, the ways in which the trees out there are dying, live trees, even aspens are not thriving, wildflowers not there. It's just, we are seeing conditions that scientists anticipated, but I think even for someone like me who's been covering climate change for almost 20 years, this year is devastating to see.
Yeah, it's heartbreaking. And you did touch on this recently. The Forest Service has implemented Stage 3 fire restrictions as of actually the start of the show at 8 o'clock this morning, which means closures of trails, roads, and the whole of the Santa Fe National Forest. Actually, this is a huge hit for people like you and I who need outdoor activity in our daily lives to get that serotonin, to feel happiness. What does that say about the broader problem of our climate crisis? Could shutting off our forests and trails be a new normal?
I think so. I think that we have not acted quickly enough on climate change. These are not surprises. We knew what was going to happen. I think, like I said, I think we're still surprised a little bit, but we knew what was going to happen. And now we're kind of acting in emergency mode, right? You know, we're talking about these forest treatments. One of the things that I have seen around Cerro Pelado and Calf Canyon is that, you know, maybe treatments that we should have been doing years ago have to be done in an emergency situation instead. You know, the dozing of fire lines, the back burning, you know, as a society, as a culture, we've not prioritized taking care of these forests in the way that we should have, whether that was a cultural resistance as Americans or funding issues or, you know, whatever. But now we're dealing with things in an emergency situation.
Mm-hmm. And with that, we're going to take a quick break. Excuse me. This morning, we're talking about forest management and wildland firefighting. Our phone lines are open, folks. Call 505-277-5866 or tweet with the hashtag Let's Talk NM. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM. I'm Bryce Dix, and we'll be right back.
Support comes from Nucenda Credit Union. They're committed to making a positive difference in their members' lives and in communities across New Mexico. Nucenda Credit Union, the power of we. Details at nucenda.org/impact. Insured by NCUA.
Listeners appreciate how nonprofit organizations are helping the community. Nonprofit underwriting at KUNM highlights your work while supporting KUNM programming. To become a nonprofit underwriter, call Aaron Steele at 505-277-2163.
Enrique Crespo was a supremely talented composer and trombonist, originally from Uruguay, but he spent most of his career in Germany writing great music for brass ensemble. We've got an example of Enrique Crespo's brassy creativity on the next Performance Today from APM.
Weekday mornings at 9 on KUNM.
Welcome back to Let's Talk New Mexico. I'm Bryce Dix, and our focus today is year-round forest management practices and the evolving role of firefighting. Are you a current or former firefighter that's left or is thinking about leaving the field because of the low pay and mental health challenges? What are your thoughts and experiences in such dangerous work? Have any ideas what needs to change there? Give us a call, 505-277-5866. That's 277-KUNM. We're also on Twitter with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. And of course, we're joined by forest ecologist Matthew Herteau and environment reporter Laura Paskus at the moment. Matthew, I want to go to you for a brief second. We had a comment from a listener in Santa Fe. She emailed us, common sense combined with knowledge about wildlife would go a long way in protecting our forests and wildlife. So-called controlled burns in New Mexico have wrought havoc before. Los Alamos devastation didn't teach the Forest Service anything. Why any burns are allowed in spring, the windiest time of the year, shows a pathetic lack of expertise and experience. Typical spring weather combined with inaccurate forecasts mean absolutely nothing. It also demonstrates the lack of consideration for wildlife, in particular native bird nestlings dying terrible deaths trapped in flammable nests, unable to escape. The bird population in this country has gone down dramatically over the last 50 years. Meanwhile, other animals have young, unable to escape in the confusion of fire, smoke, and fear. We have likely lost thousands of birds, coyote pups, mountain lion kits, bear cubs, squirrels, bobcat kittens, and other precious forest creatures in this latest monstrous uncontrolled fire they belong. I did want to ask you, what's your response to that? Because there is a little bit of criticism of controlled burning there and its effects on wildlife. What goes into planning a prescribed burn that is in consideration of wildlife? How do burn bosses consider that?
Yeah, so there are all kinds of parameters that influence, when and where things occur in terms of prescribed burning. But I think the root core question there is really about the effects that this big monstrous wildfire is having on these wildlife populations, right? And so particularly in the low and mid elevation forests where Calf Canyon's burning, those forests burned with high frequency, right? And that's the disturbance type that these animals are accustomed to. And, you know, we're seeing explosive fire growth because of the combined effects of fire suppression and climate change. And those do present significant challenges to animals. The small scale prescribed burning that's happened, like a 1,200 acre burn, you know, that's going to have relatively little impact on wildlife populations.
Yeah. Well, we were just before we were on break, we were talking to Laura Paskus. You've done some digging into folks who are on the front lines of these fires, wildland firefighters. As I take it, there are some mental health issues going on and pay is low. Yeah. What's going on there? What is your reporting showing?
Yeah, so we started reporting on this last year at NMPBS, and you know, I was really taken aback. I think that I thought that federal wildland firefighters, as federal employees, as people we all appreciate and respect, I assumed that they were being compensated fairly for their work protecting our communities, and I learned that I was very wrong in that. And through the course of the reporting, you know, learned about the low pay and the lack of benefits and all of that, but also the mental and physical pressures that are put on these men and women who are essentially working what's now a year-round fire season. You're not only facing these dangerous conditions and, you know, sort of emergency situations for long periods of time, you're also, you know, struggling with this longer fire season, with low pay, with all kinds of these various physical and mental challenges. You know, I think one thing that we saw last year was firefighter Tim Hart was killed due to his work on a fire here in New Mexico. And you see his family has to have a GoFundMe campaign to be paying for the funeral expenses and medical expenses. And so Yeah, I think Jonathan will talk a lot more about that than I can. But since doing that reporting, I've heard so many stories from current and former wildland firefighters who are facing these incredible challenges that most of us don't even think about.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this does remind me of a recent segment you taped on Our Land recently called of this thing called climate anxiety, which I've been thinking about a lot. I have climate anxiety myself, to be honest. How can folks come to terms with what we're seeing in front of our eyes, especially when livelihoods and property are being lost at this very moment?
Yeah, so I think even if you're not being evacuated, even if you're not facing flames or water shortages, we all still have this underlying anxiety about what is happening and what we see happening. And one of the things that I think is most useful, and I'm thankful to be a reporter and be able to kind of put this into practice every day, but is understanding what, you know, kind of narrowing your focus a little bit. You can't do something about everything. So kind of deciding what you have a little bit of control over and where you can have some influence. Is your sphere of influence with your family, your neighborhood association, your lawmakers? You know, where can you really have an impact? And trying to kind of just hone your actions. And I think that can give people a great deal of control over what's happening, because you can decide where you can make an impact and try to make a positive difference. But when you're trying, when you're constantly assaulted by fires here, flooding there, you know, the heat wave in Pakistan, yeah. We are being inundated with this understanding of what we've done to our planet. And so kind of just trying to hone in and make a difference where you can, I think, does a great deal in quelling that anxiety.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, I do have a couple more questions from a listener. And I do want to ask you, Matthew, I think you're the most qualified. You may not know this answer. And if we don't, we'll get these answers to you after the show. But they have two questions. Why is farming still permitted in these kinds of dense forests? And they have farmed them from over 100 years, but that's not long. That's not long enough. These areas should be curated. And two, why do they address damage via burnt structures when a prescribed burn is burned? The true economic damage is the loss of trees and the loss of vital habitat for animals. I think what they're asking here is, should we reevaluate the way we evaluate fire damage in the wake of global warming and in terms of the forest damage, and put economic resources into maybe reseeding those areas? I think that's what they're asking.
So I don't know the answer to the first part of that question. But the second part is, you know, those of us who look at the ecology of the system, and actually it's called the burned area emergency rehab that happens after the fire. These BEAR teams go in and they assess the impacts on the ecosystem and try and figure out what needs to happen. Most of that stuff we don't value economically, in the sense that there's not a market for it, right? There's not a market value on this stuff, but there's a lot of effort that goes into helping to rehabilitate the ecosystem immediately after a big hot fire.
Mm-hmm. I do want to go to a caller. David, you're live on air. What do you want to say, or what's your comment?
Great. Thank you. Good morning. I wanted to ask a question about forest thinning for fire management. And because of our extreme drought, how some of the practices, if they're happening or not, are viable or not. But in terms of ground fires turning into crown fires, getting rid of ladder fuels is important, like removing debris piles, but also the dead lower branches of trees. And in such a drought condition, just pruning trees causes so much stress that the trees will most likely die instead of survive a fire. So I'd be wondering about what kind of practices are in place here in the dry Southwest. But more importantly, I'm a pine botanist, and there's two trees in our region that are kind of interesting, the limber pine and the southwestern white pine. And the limber pine comes into our region from the north, and the southwestern white pine comes into our region from Mexico. And it just so happens that on Earth, there are two loci of evolution in pine trees, one of which is Japan, but the other one is southwestern U.S. and northern Mexico. And it just so happens that the limber pine and the southwestern white pine are hybridizing here in our region and evolving into a new type of pine species. And I'm wondering if when you curate a forest for thinning, you consider not removing the existing limber pine or southwestern white pine to allow for the evolutionary process that's going on right now. Thank you.
Thank you for that call, David. I think that's a question for Matthew Herto yet again. I guess he was asking about trimming and considering limber pine to be protected. Do we exclude certain kinds of trees from being cut? Let's say if a firefighter is building a fire line somewhere, does that even happen?
So when the firefighters are working on an active fire, you know, the consideration is basically where is it safe to put in control features. But I think the caller's talking about beforehand and the actual like management of the forest. And there's two pieces. One, we don't actually prune trees, right? Fire will prune trees, burn off those lower branches and stuff. But the thinning piece is about removing smaller trees. And when you get into areas where limber pine or southwestern white pine occur, oftentimes in that thinning prescription, there are considerations for species composition and size. And so, you know, there are species that get preferentially left.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, with that, I do want to welcome our next guest, Jonathan Golden, who is on the line from Utah. He's a former firefighter of 12 years and is heavily involved with wildland firefighting policy at the federal level. Hey, Jonathan.
Hi, thanks for having me on this morning.
Awesome. And then as a former wildland firefighter yourself, can you tell us what a normal working conditions look like on the job?
A typical day on a fire assignment will start anywhere at 5 in the morning and, kind of getting all of our, pre-day checks, making sure that we're good to go for the morning, attending a morning briefing to dole out operational assignments, and then, heading out to the line to begin to do, fire suppression, control work, mitigation, whatever it might be that we're doing. And that goes until typically about 10 p.m. in the evening is when we get a chance to usually call it a day. Sometimes, though, fire has other plans for us. If we're working in the wildland-urban interface around neighborhoods or critical infrastructure, we could be going for full 24 hours up to, 30 hours in some cases, just because we need to have all hands on deck and really try to take the oomph out of a fire or protect homes and lives in and around communities. Mm-hmm. You try to sneak a bite to eat every now and then, and you're on your feet, you're go, go, go. It's hot, it's dusty, it's smoky. You're just in it together with the person, on either side of you.
Well, and can you talk about this state of like quasi homelessness firefighters are constantly subjected to? They're living out of their rigs and sometimes, or even rat infested cabins, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this is a what I like to call like a quasi transient job. Very in my experience, very few people had lived in the town where the duty station that they worked at, and they're usually coming from all over the country, various backgrounds, kind of drawn to this idea of, working on public land, doing a noble job. And sometimes housing was not an option or is not, something that either was provided in the form of government barracks, or if it was, it was very run down, rough, sharing our quarters with sometimes four-legged critters. Or you're living in a vehicle and just kind of hoping for that fire assignment so that you're on the road and away and out, and then ultimately you're sleeping on the ground more times than not. on a, you know, piece of ground where the fire is at. So, yeah, there is a real problem with housing and homelessness. As a former hiring manager, you know, the second question I always got asked was, do you have housing available? And which times no is typically a deal breaker for the prospective candidate.
Mm-hmm. And Laura, I saw you raise your hand. You wanted to say something real quick?
Yeah, I just wanted to mention when we were up in the Las Vegas area earlier this month, you know, stopped by the fire camp and we couldn't go inside the gate, but we could see what it looked like. And, you know, there are trucks there for showers and meal tents, but where these men and women are sleeping are in tents along the side of the highway, along I-25. And, you know, it was just one of these days when it was incredibly windy. And to just to think that these people are working so hard and their attempts at rest are in these tents being battered by wind along the side of the highway.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jonathan, reporting from NPR and the Mountain West News Bureau, among other news outlets, is saying there's a national shortage of firefighters. And we did just hear a little bit from Laura on that, why that might be. But there's other reasons, right? There's lack of budget, job competition, lack of PPE.
Yeah, I mean it's an increasingly tight labor market, and you know at the end of the day, what's going into people's wallets really dictates where they work. You know, for the work that you know we're asked to do for federal wildland firefighters, oftentimes you know, we're kind of at the lower end of the pay when it comes to our brothers and sisters in municipal departments and state agencies. So, you know, for example, like in a 2-week period while on a wildfire, a highly qualified federal wildland firefighter serving as like a top level incident commander who is responsible for the lives of thousands of firefighters in public while protecting our communities and infrastructure. They're often paid, you know, a third to a quarter of an entry-level municipal firefighter on that same fire. And so a lot of folks are opting to leave the land management agencies for municipal departments that offer better pay, better work-life balance, you know, access to mental health, and also, you know, presumptive health care coverage as well.
Mm-hmm. I do have an email from a listener, Edmund McWilliams. He says, I think there needs to be a greater financial and benefit support for federal firefighters. Pay is inadequate and benefits do not expand into non-fire season. I also think firefighters from prisons should be given better compensation and should be encouraged to become professional firefighters once they are released. And, you know, Jonathan, wildland firefighters, as we've been talking about, are both involved in managing our forests and protecting them from these large blazes, meaning they battle blazes and carry out prescribed burns. Really quickly, this is obviously a lot to ask of firefighters. What's the issue with that?
Well, yeah, it's just that we're increasingly tasked with more to do, and we have fewer resources to do it. So, you know, we're expected to do land management work, but fire suppression is this, you know, turning out to be ongoing year-round emergency, which doesn't leave us any time to do the land management work that needs to be done. And frankly, I think that we need to start thinking about, for the 21st century, a dedicated land management workforce and a dedicated fire suppression workforce as well, and if we're going to meet these land management objectives.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jonathan Golden is a former firefighter and policy advocate. Thank you for taking the time to join us, and we'll keep you on the line if folks call in for questions for you. This morning, we're talking about forest management here in the Southwest. We want to hear your thoughts or questions about our devastating fire season this year. Our phone lines are still open. You can call us at 505-277-5866 to join in on the conversation. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. I'm Bryce Dix, and we'll be back in a minute.
Students and family members are celebrating the educational milestone of graduation this time of year. For Native grads, it's a time to draw on their support systems and chart the next path after clearing hurdles that many others haven't. We'll check in with some graduates and find out what they've learned as they mark this important time on the next Native America Calling.
weekday mornings at 11 on KUNM.
I'm Maria Hinojosa. Next time on Latino USA, an intimate exploration of how migration and depression interlock.
Migrating, just like depression, is not a single event. It happens every day when you get up. It happens every time you meet someone and they notice your accent. It happens every time something important happens back at home, and you're not there for that.
That's next time on Latino USA.
That's Latino USA, Monday mornings at 8 a.m. on KUNM.
You're listening to Let's Talk New Mexico on KUNM. I'm Bryce Dix. We're talking about forest management this morning, and we want to hear your thoughts. Have you been affected by this year's fire season, or do you have questions on how to protect your property from future blazes? Let us know. Call 277-KUNM. That's 505-277-5866. You can also tweet us using the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. On that note, I want to go to another guest we have on the line. We're joined by Tom Reby, co-founder of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology, or FUSE, and the author of the book Inferno by Committee. Thanks for being here this morning, Tom.
Great. Thanks. Nice to join you.
So FUSE does lots of advocacy that embraces fire as a tool that can help protect rural communities, restore ecosystems, and preserve species in those ecosystems. Can you talk to me about the large cost of fire suppression and the impact those dollars have on taxpayers?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question. FUSE started in the Pacific Northwest. Its roots are up in Oregon, and we've become a national organization. Our focus initially was to try and steer fire management to a more progressive, more scientifically oriented, and more sensitive parameter. And it's just been a lot of what we've been focusing on is the damage that is done to the landscape by various firefighting practices. For example, running bulldozers to make fire lines in wilderness areas and backfiring, which in some cases can be damaging. It's a necessary practice in many cases, but we were trying to get people to focus on what is going on, having the public be involved and aware of the sorts of practices that firefighters use, especially on large suppression events like what we're experiencing in New Mexico. And in terms of budgeting, touching on some of the issues that Jonathan talked about, just a question of how we're allocating funds, how we're allocating personnel to both natural fire, which is like lightning-started fire that's allowed to spread when conditions are right, or prescribed fire versus suppression. Suppression always takes the lion's share of the budget.
Well, and it does sound like very little, if any, of these, and I believe it's billions of dollars a year and go into fire suppression efforts here in the United States. Very little of that money goes into the pockets of firefighters themselves across the country, it sounds like. Does it make sense for this model of firefighter workplace conditions of low pay and lack of equipment, as we're hearing, to continue?
Yeah, and that's a really question, because I've worked with the National Park Service as a prescribed fire practitioner for many years now, both in Yosemite and Valles Caldera National Preserve and Bandelier National Monument, which have a substantial fire program. And I've gotten to meet a lot of people from all over the country and get to know fire people who are here in New Mexico. And I'm seeing over the years, I'm old enough now to have watched this for quite a while now, and what I'm seeing is low morale, discouraged fire personnel because of the lack of, it used to be back in the 1970s and 80s that so many people wanted to work for the federal land agencies or the state land agencies that they would put up with just about anything. It was really a romantic time and a wonderful time. The people who came into all of this at that time are aging out. The younger people are, as Jonathan noted, are thinking about other options. And they need to have decent pay. It needs to be treated as a profession that it is. It's not just grunt work. This is not like I don't want to degrade some other profession, but you know, there's a great deal of knowledge that goes into being a fire manager at whatever level you're at. And that needs to be honored. The people need to have full benefits, and they need to have pay that's at least twice what they're getting now, so that we can retain people. It's dangerous. It threatens your health to do this work, but it's public service, and it's a fantastically interesting adventure to be involved with it. But it's people also need to be able to have families and have stability.
Yeah. And well, let me jump in here and say that there's this interesting bill your organization helped pass in Oregon that established this thing called the Oregon Conservation Corps. Can you explain what that is and how a state like New Mexico might benefit from doing something similar?
As I understand it, I wasn't involved with our campaign on that, but as I understand it, they've created a statewide system or budget and system of to employ young people and get them involved with various conservation work. And that could be all kinds of things, from stuff in cities and city parks, all the way to getting people trained up to do agency work as a career. So that's as far as I can tell, they've created a personnel structure in the state, and they budgeted for it so that they can start to pull people in, young people, especially in some of their more rural communities, and get them aware of the professions that are available to them through agencies and get them started in that direction. And we could certainly do that in New Mexico. I think rural northern New Mexico, where I spend a lot of time, Rio Arriba County and San Miguel County, these are the sorts of places where there's a lot of young people who could get involved with these professions. And especially as we see conditions improve in the professions, it'd be a wonderful thing for them. And you know, there's been a lot of people talking about the Hermit Peak fire and how many people from out of state are there. Well, that's necessary, of course. That's what we have available. But it'd be great if more locals were also able to do this work.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do want to go to forest ecologist Matthew Hertaux, who's in studio with us, with a question about that. What do you think about an idea like that? Could something like that work here in New Mexico?
Yeah, so we already have some not-for-profits doing that sort of work, like the Forest Steward Guild operates youth crews. You know, we're actually contracted to hire their youth crews to help plant some trees for an experiment following high-severity wildfire for one of our projects. And so, but yeah, it's institutionalizing it and funding it would be fantastic.
Mm-hmm. I do have a caller on the line. Susan, you're on the air. What's your question or comment?
My comment is that it's so sad to see how bad our state is burning. And honestly, I honestly feel that in the years before, it was never this bad because we had loggers up there. They would go cut down trees and sell, blah, blah. But they would also have to clean their areas. Nobody cleans our forest anymore. I come from a little town in New Mexico, northern New Mexico. I live up in like in the mountain, and the property around me, the dead trees, the dead brush. If there's a lightning that strikes there, a lot of us will probably not get out because it's how bad it is. It's in Sandoval County. We need to do something about those forest fires, not sparking up the way they are, and I think that logging is what would help
you. Okay, thank you so much, Susan, for that call. I do want to put that question to Laura Paska. She had her hand up. What's your response to that?
Yeah, so, you know, kind of the logging industry has not been sustainable or profitable in the Southwest forever. I'm not sure, but it just could not possibly compete on a global market. Sort of all other factors aside, New Mexico logging industry just couldn't compete on a global market. But there are some projects out there that are really exciting and interesting. We did a show last year about the Cerro Negro Forest Council, and they're doing, you know, local people are going out there, and it's based around, it's a structure that's very similar to the acequia and mayordomo system, where local people are out there in the forests doing thinning, firewood sales, all kinds of things like that. So these smaller scale community projects like that one and some other ones that are modeled on that are really exciting and happening around the state.
Mm-hmm. I do have a comment from a caller, Douglas. He says he sees the firefighters in camps, but also in local hotels, which seems to contrast with the working conditions the guests were talking about here on the program. Tom Reby, still on the line with us. Here's a question for you. Are there different levels of seniority for housing for firefighters in these areas?
Oh, that's a good question. I think, and Jonathan can chime in on this also, I think that it depends on where the fire is happening. If you're in an area like Las Vegas, New Mexico, there are probably better housing situations for the incident command folks. And there's a lot of incident command people there. They've got five different teams on it. But the firefighters at the level that I always worked at are intense. And I would say it's probably somewhat related to the level of training that the person has that's where they're going to be living.
Okay, thank you, Tom. Laura, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, when we were up at the fire camp outside of Las Vegas, I asked that question, and it depends what agency you work for. If you're in a tent, if you're in a motel, or if you're in some other kind of accommodation, and generally speaking, pilots are put up in hotels or motels, and maybe supervisors and things like that. But, you know, the people out there fighting the fires that I saw are sleeping on the ground.
Awesome. Well, thanks for chatting with us. That was Tom Reby with FUSE, Firefighters United for Safety, Ecology, and Safety, Ethics, and Ecology, excuse me. And finally, we have Arturo Archuleta on the line. He is the Program Manager with the New Mexico Land Grant Council at the University of New Mexico. Welcome.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Good, thank you.
So land grants are a historical piece of New Mexico that were given to citizens under the Mexican and Spanish governments for many reasons, like as a buffer between very populated areas and Native American tribes. Also known as common lands, there are about 250,000 acres of these lands across the state, including some forested uplands. The idea is that this land is used by a community for whatever it needs, like agriculture, timber, and hunting. It's also very important to point out that only a fraction of the original common lands currently exist today. Arturo, can you walk me through how your organization helps facilitate forest management on these land grants?
Sure. So I work for the New Mexico Land Grant Council, and we're a state agency whose primary mission is to provide a program of support for Spanish and Mexican land grant communities that are political subdivisions of the state. And so in that capacity, we also serve as a liaison between those communities and federal and state, different federal and state agencies, including land management agencies like the U.S. Forest Service, the Bureau of Land Management, State Land Office. And so we'll work primarily with those communities on trying to sort of improve their relationship to those former common lands in terms of whether it be policy development. We work very closely and heavily on the forest plan revision process for the three northern central forests, the Santa Fe, the Cibola, and the Carson, and as well as just sort of helping those communities engage their local ranger districts. We also work with the land grants themselves that have lands on trying to sort of assist them with identifying funding for projects. And sort of how do they manage those lands.
Mm-hmm. And as I take it, it's not all smooth sailing, though. Can you tell me about these sub-land grants that are having difficulty managing their forests?
Sure. I think what you're referring to is the we have some grants that have been affected by the fire in the Las Vegas area. They're actually what we call sub-grants or partition grants, which essentially... These communities are land grant communities. They actually, some of these towns, for example, Lower Gainas, Los Vigiles are two of these subgrants of the Las Vegas land grant. Those communities were actually established before the grant was even established. And they, as part of their history, they were separated in terms of the land ownership from the Las Vegas land grant back in the 1950s. The Las Vegas land grant is managed and controlled by the 4th Judicial District of New Mexico. It's got its own specific statute. And at that time in the 1950s, the board that was appointed by the 4th Judicial District started selling these properties off. And so those communities came forward and said, hey, you can't sell our common lands. We rely on those. And so as a result, they deeded to them about 3,500 acres apiece, which they then manage on behalf of the community with a board of trustees like any other land grant. But because they weren't a land grant that received a patent from the U.S. government, the way that our statutes were developed during the territorial period, land grants that were recognized were those that officially received a deed from either Spain or Mexico. And because these ones have a deed that comes in the U.S. era in the 1950s, they kind of have been these quasi-recognized entities. And so they've had some challenges over the years to access funds through New Mexico State Forestry. During the Martinez administration, they'd actually, the Los Vigiles grant had gotten some money for forest restoration, but then when they realized they wanted a unit of government, they had to take it back because of the state's anti-donation clause. Mm-hmm. And so since, probably at least the past 6 to 8 years, we've been working on trying to get them recognized as units of government on their own, which the state of New Mexico, through the legislative process, has the authority to do. And unfortunately, we haven't been successful at getting them across the finish line. It's passed both the House and the Senate 3 times, but it's been pocket vetoed, largely because of some opposition, sort of local opposition to, I think, folks that just don't understand the concept. And it's really unfortunate because, you know, these communities are really just trying to serve their communities and improve their watersheds. Yeah. And now both of those grants have suffered losses anywhere from 1/3 to 3/4 of their common lands have been burnt, which not only affects them and their ability to use those resources, but it also impacts the watershed downstream in the community of Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm. And well, and really quick, we're nearing the end of this hour, but how do these land grant communities manage their forests without the proper cash to do it? It sounds like they just need a lot of volunteers and a lot of sweat, right?
Yep, that's exactly what it is. It's volunteers. And they're still, even today, I've been talking with the folks, and they're rolling up their sleeves and they're ready to get back to work and figuring out how they're going to deal with this mitigation. And we're hopeful that we can actually get them across the finish line, get them recognized in this next legislative session. That'll open them up for an opportunity to apply for funding and to also get we passed a bill last session that provides land grants or units of government with a guaranteed revenue stream for the state. If we can get them recognized as a unit of government, they'll be able to get access to money on an annual basis from the state of New Mexico, which they can put to work for some of those mitigation efforts.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling in, Arturo. That is all the time we have today. Thanks to everyone who called in and to each of our guests. We have Matthew Herteau, Laura Paskus, Jonathan Golden, Tom Reby, and of course, Arturo Archuleta, who you just heard. We can keep the conversation going on Twitter with the hashtag #LetsTalkNM. We're also on Facebook, too, at KUNM Radio. If you missed a part of the show, you can stream it online or subscribe to the podcast. We'll have the show posted on the episodes page at KUNM.org shortly, along with a list of the resources that were mentioned throughout the hour. Thank you, as always, to our hardworking team. Our engineer is Marino Spencer. Daniel Montano screened your calls and subbed in for me on Morning Edition earlier today. Thank you, Daniel. The live tweeting was done by Taylor Velasquez, and Megan Kamrick produced today's show. I'm Bryce Dix. This is Let's Talk New Mexico on 89.9 KUNM.